Why do we always feel better after we move our body? Well, today I wanted to find out. So I sat down with Dr. John Rady and fellow podcast host and coach Travis Macy to get to the bottom of it. Welcome to the Sonia Looney Show. This is a podcast on how to live in the intersection of high performance and well-being, and I'm really excited about today's episode with Dr. John Rady. If you're anything like me, you're passionate about living your best life, and that includes prioritizing movement, connection, and spending time in nature. I know these activities changed my life and my experience, but what's fascinating is the science behind it. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, in fact, we are coming up on 7 years next month, and we'll have a surprise for you on our 7-year anniversary. You know that I like the evidence behind things, from plant-based nutrition to psychology to everything else in between. We always are talking about the science behind things on this podcast. So when Dr. John Rady was a guest lecturer last semester, I'm doing my master's in applied positive psychology. He was a guest lecturer talking about the benefits of exercise, the neuroscience behind exercise. I was fascinated and I had to have him on the show. So Dr. John Rady is a brilliant psychiatrist and professor at Harvard to explore the evolutionary and cognitive benefits of movement, nature, and social connection. We talk about how exercise is like rocket fuel for our brains. In fact, there is something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And since I learned that term, I've been laughing and thinking about making a t-shirt that says, I love BDNF, because that is what makes our brains work so well after we exercise. We also talked about how it can positively impact everything from ADHD to pregnancy, and why incorporating movement into workplaces and schools is an absolute no-brainer. Plus, why shared experiences and activities like CrossFit can strengthen our connections and embrace our individual strengths. And I actually would hazard to guess, and I think we actually talked about this in the podcast, the power of mountain bike stage races, because you are doing things together, you are doing the same course, you're sharing the experience, you are building that camaraderie every single day. I'm pretty excited because my first stage race of the year is coming up in about 6 weeks, the Transylvania Epic in Pennsylvania. I can't wait to return to that race after a lot of adversity I faced back in 2017, where I was in the leader's jersey. I had suffered third-degree burns all over the upper portion of my body right before the race, but I was still racing. And then I ended up breaking my frame. So that was kind of a bummer. I still finished the race. I borrowed a spectator's Walmart bike and finished the stage, but I received a time penalty for accepting outside support, and that put me out of contention for the podium, but I still finished. So that's kind of off topic, but this is why these things are amazing. This is why we should go after these adventures, because you have stories to tell when you're done, even whenever they were hard, and that is where meaning comes from. Dr. Rady is a true visionary who's written some absolute game changer books like Spark and Go Wild, which explore the powerful connection between exercise and brain health. And I couldn't imagine a better co-host than endurance athlete and author Travis Macy. He has been on the show with me as a guest. He has been on the show with me as a co-host, and he's a very good friend. So I'm so excited to share the science with you. And I know that you'll want to share this with others. Let's go.
Well, Dr. Rady, welcome to the podcast. So excited to be here with you and with you as well, Sonia. I was so excited for this today. I got on this recording platform an hour early. I was so excited. And then I realized that we weren't starting yet and I had a couple other client calls to make. So I'm just I'm pumped to be here. And Dr. Rady, I got to tell you on a personal note, just thanks for your work, especially around ADHD. You know, about 10 years ago, my son was two or three, and I was kind of coming to terms that that he probably has ADHD, and that in fact I do as well, which I think is a fairly common experience to learn more about it that way. And that's when I was initially introduced to Driven to Distraction, which was your first book on the topic. Now getting to be a fairly old book, but you've written three more in the series, including the newest ADHD 2.0, which is been just a great update and super helpful. And then your other books, especially Spark and Go Wild. They've all really helped me. I'm just super excited to talk about movement, evolution, the brain, all this stuff. And maybe my first question, you know, getting into these things is, you know, humans evolved and we were born to do a lot of these things, to move, to seek novelty, to eat lots of different things, to live communally. What are the other things, Dr. Rady, that you think we were born to do? And what are the some ways that we're doing or not doing those things in modern life?
I think we were born to live in nature, live outside much more than we are, you know, and that's the one thing that, you know, people are focusing on now, thankfully, these days, is you got to get outside. You got to get that sun, you know, to hit you. And it's one of the reasons why we come to Hawaii, because it's all outside. And that's great. You know, it's and I know you both are outside people, outdoorsmen, and which is great. But I think that's one thing. And then the big new news, I think, is how important connection is. In our books, we always talk about connection.
I noticed in the book Spark, Dr. Rady, you call that connection, you call it vitamin C. And you talk about the importance of not only exercising, but exercising with someone else. Humans, dogs, donkeys.
It is so important. I mean, there's so much that we get from it, so much that makes us weller in every way, physically and mentally. You know, the studies are now coming out, looking at the science of it, looking at the facts of how important it is. And factually, it's really, really important. It's about 5 times more important that you're more social than it is for you to take your medicine as your doctor prescribed as you're aging, you know, because it's pretty impressive how important it is to be with others and to connect with others. And that's one of the things that we talk about in all of our ADD books, but also all the books I've written in looking at wellness. There's nothing that beats the human moment. And you mentioned the dogs. If you have a dog, it's like I call it a dog is like oxytocin on 4 legs. You know, then oxytocin is the love hormone and the bonding hormone, and there's nothing better than an animal that's bred for our companionship, to be with, to love, and be loved by. I mean, there's so much we know nowadays. Doing things in the world has an effect on our bodies and especially on our brains. And that's, I think that was the big news about Spark, you know, because it really was something that people sort of knew. They thought they knew. They thought they understood it. We had the word endorphins thrown around from the late 70s, and when the Boston Marathon people began to take their blood and see what was different, and their endorphin levels were higher, and this is why we thought you reach that nirvana level, and you know, you can run through the pain, but there's a lot more that goes on than just the endorphins and the endogenous morphines. What endorphins are, but we have all kinds of stuff that happens when we move and we exercise, including we change up our chemistry very acutely and chronically. If you're a chronic exerciser, you're changing all the machinery in your brain. All those 100 billion nerve cells are really growing and getting stronger and tougher and more resilient, and this is the way to look at all the cells in the body, but certainly for the brain.
Yeah, I think that with relationships, I think somewhere it said that like taking medication and exercising and quitting smoking all takes grit, but socializing is easier to sustain. But something that I want to make a point out for high performance athletes is that a lot of times people will train by themselves because they need to execute a workout, or maybe there's weirdness around competition. So for high performance endurance athletes, or maybe people who are just super busy in their lives, they don't prioritize relationships whenever it is the most important thing that they're supposed to be doing. So I think for some people, it actually does require grit in order to have relationships and to make sure that those are our priority.
Oh yeah, no. It no matter what, even if you're not a high performance athlete, you know, the biggest change in our social environment these days is loneliness. You know, there's just yesterday read something that finally the U.S. is talking about developing a minister of loneliness, which they have in the U.K. and Canada and various countries, and certainly Japan and the Asian countries have been very aware of this, that it's not just for the elderly, but that certainly you see it there, but for everyone to really take part in bonding and being with others.
I hadn't heard that. Thanks for sharing that. To build on what you said, Dr. Rady, about, you know, if someone is exercising consistently or you might say chronically, they're creating these changes, these ongoing changes. Sometimes in reading or in conversation, you hear about a potential negative side of this. You hear about, you know, a term like exercise addiction or exercise dependence. My read in your book Spark was that, in your opinion, it seems that these aren't really things that we should worry about too much, or that we should see as, you know, sort of as negatives. And I'm personally very curious about that, because, you know, I mean, I know that I am a different person when I don't exercise, and it doesn't feel good. And I wonder, like, people say they hate exercising, and I'm like, man, if I do not exercise, I don't like life. I feel like a different person, and I'm surprised every day. I go out and today I jog around with my dogs, and I came back and I just felt like a totally different person. So anyway, I'm kind of going on and on, but like, why should we not worry about, you know, sort of this addiction aspect that is discussed?
Well, look, I think the reason why I poo-pooed it in all of my books is because people use it as an excuse not to exercise. You know, I mean, anything to not exercise is what I want to stick a needle in, you know, and say, no, that's not, it's not something to worry about. Yes, for a lot of people it is. You can get to that point. And yeah, you're in withdrawal when you're not exercising because you're doing it chronically. But you do that with everything, you know, and not just exercise. You know, it's like whatever you're used to, you change that. That changes your body and your brain a bit. Exercise, it's very, you know, you see that you see your difference. You see that you're withdrawing, like you're withdrawing from a drug, because you know, you're dependent on upping all those wonderful hormones, neurotransmitters, changes in oxygen flow, blood flow through your body and your brain. You don't have that, you're going to be a different being. And if you're used to that every day, and that gets you started and keeps you going, then when you miss it, you're going to feel it. And so will your family and friends and your dogs.
The dogs do for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to actually ask you, Dr. Rady, because, you know, you've had some illnesses. I have two toddlers, so I'm always sick. How do you manage knowing when to exercise when you're sick versus taking time completely off? Because this is something that I'm really struggling with right now.
Okay, so I'm in day six of COVID, and I have that same question. So I start the morning getting purposely here in Hawaii, we live a mile away from Starbucks, but I'm there at 5 o'clock in the morning getting my coffee for the 2 mile walk back and forth. Right. And so, but that just starts the day for me here usually. But now, you know, I had a couple of days that I was just really lounging in bed and throughout the day, and now I'm ready to go, but I'm still positive on my tests this morning. So So the question is, what should I do? Like, it's the same with you. You know, you're the tail end of an illness. What should you do? Well, be smart. Do it. Do as much as you feel you can, and you're not going to overextend. And you know, but, you know, what you do is when you exercise, you jimmy up your immune system, the positive side of the immune system, to help deal with whatever's bothering you. You know, whether it's a virus or bacteria, but there's really no great answer to that question. You really have to depend on your own, you know, your own total assessment of yourself.
So let's get dorky here. Let's hear about BDNF.
Okay. Yeah, BDNF. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Boy, that for many years, that was my favorite hormone, or neurohormone, because, and it still is, because it's so powerful. You know, it is it is miracle growth for the brain, and it really helps our brain cells. We have 100 billion of them, helps them to grow and stay very much on the growth side, because if we're not growing, we're dying, we're eroding, and that's the way our cells are, and so the brain especially is keen on that. So when we exercise, we release a lot of this BDNF from our nerve cells, from the nerve cells itself, so that it's like we're, you know, evolution has given us this big plus to when we're using our brain cells, then we're going to be able to continue to use them and actually make them stronger and grow. And so, you know, when you exercise, you're helping your cells grow and get stronger, get tougher, get more resilient, resilient to stress, resilient to overuse. You know, you don't overuse it. I mean, and that's why a big thing when I was researching Spark that was really emphasized by a lot of the scientists that was just sort of emerging back there in the early 2000s is that the brain, you can think of the brain as a muscle. So, you know, the way you guys, both athletes, you train your muscles, and it's not that you can overdo it, but most of the times you don't. You sort of stop when you reach you take it to the max. But the brain is the same way. It doesn't wear out. It gets better, gets bigger, and that's a big part of what BDNF is. Now, one thing that I don't know whether I did emphasized it in my book, but the drug companies, when they're looking for a new antidepressant, what are they measuring these days? That, you know, no more serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine. They're measuring BDNF. What medicines increase BDNF? So because it's not... it's an all-purpose neurohormone that helps maintain our mood, helps us deal with stress, helps us deal with anxiety. So it's an antidepressant, anti-anxiety agent, and as well as a growth hormone to help ourselves grow, which means to help us be able to think and remember and be smarter.
I like that. Thanks for sharing. Building on the hormone conversation, there's a great section in Spark where you're talking about hormonal changes over time across the lifespan and brain health, both for women and for men. In a nutshell, what should we know about that? What's not in the common knowledge about hormonal shifts over time?
Well, one of the big ones is a drop in growth hormone. You know, I mean, the for a while there, everybody in Hollywood and actors and athletes were taking growth hormone, you know. I don't know whether they still are, but probably. But growth hormone is something that sort of stops getting more and more in your system as you hit about age 30, 33, something like that. It sort of comes down to a small level. And one of the reasons why we age is because we don't have this growth hormone and we're not growing. And this growth hormone is general for all kinds, all of our cells. However, when you exercise, you boost the growth hormone, especially when you go like you guys do. You know, you guys are crazy athletes. You know, and when you do, you're walking up the ski lift like you do, ski slope like you told me the other day you were doing. I said, Jesus. Well, then you're maxing out like that. You get a heck of a lot of changes in your brain, including a lot of growth hormone coming out because it's like your body's responding, say, well, we need this to grow. We need to grow bigger. We need to grow more, better. And so that's, you know, evolution created a pretty damn good machine, you know, that responsive to the environment, responsive to our needs. So, but that's one of the big changes. And the section on women in Spark was all about hormonal changes as well, and how exercise helps to regulate the fluctuations in hormones that women have. And I think it's now coming out more and more studies showing that women should continue to exercise when they're pregnant, and certainly right after they deliver, and you know, to keep themselves, keep their moods stable and to keep their hormones from too much fluctuation and leading to depression and anxiety and all the rest.
Yeah, I want to comment on that really quickly because I mountain biked until the day before I delivered both of my children, and I was back on my bike 7 to 10 days after delivery. Certainly this isn't the case for everybody, but there's always a lot of concern around, well, is it safe to exercise while you're pregnant? When should you get back? Maybe you should wait 3 months. There's a great book just for people listening called Exercising Through Your Pregnancy by John Clapp and Catherine Cram. So if you're looking for information there, I just wanted to give that as a quick nod. And one more quick nod for the women is Stacey Sims is a leader in this field of hormones and women and training. So she has a book that just came out about menopause and perimenopause called Next Level, and also Roar for premenopausal women, including all of these different conditions.
That's great. See, this is all recent because when one of the chapters that we had to cut a lot out was the women's chapter because it was too big, because I was so excited because it was just beginning. We were beginning to have this news. A lot of it was, oh, I think it might be good for you, or I think it might, you know, I mean, there wasn't the science, and now we're getting to the science. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there was really only one real investigator at the looking at pregnant moms and exercise. He was at Case Western Reserve, very, you know, my world, a very famous OBGYN guy, and, you know, following these moms and what their babies were like, and their babies, were they armed because mom exercise right up until they're like you did, right, you know, right on the bike? No. What about their babies? Well, their babies were longer, and which is something, you know, and they weren't underfed by the in the womb, but they were, you know, and he followed a bunch of them into their high school years of moms who exercised a lot, and they were smarter. They were quicker to pick up information and had better memories and all that, and higher IQs. But, you know, that was, it's still probably all speculation because you can't, how do you control for that? My God, you know, it's, there's so many things, but at least it I found it very pleasing to use his information and make, you know, outrageous conclusions from it, but it, because it, at least it pointed in that direction.
Yeah, so, yeah. Good stuff, Sonia. I'm glad you brought up Stacy Sims. She's one of my favorite interviews that I've done, and she talks about lifting heavy shit and all kinds of other stuff. But we'll get that linked in the show notes. Dr. Rady, I'm curious about your own journey with exercise. I learned that as a kid, you initially took up tennis. I think you thought about football. As I understand, your brother was the backup high school quarterback to Joe Namath.
My brother, we were in the same lake, Beaver and Beaver Falls.
Oh, okay.
It was Beaver Falls because of Joe Namath, but he was at Beaver and my brother was a year ahead. My brother was first team all county, and Joe Namath was second team all county when Joe
all
was
right,
a junior.
So he was ahead of Namath. All right.
No, but junior, senior. Joe Namath is a junior then. My brother was a senior. So, but anyway, I came from that tradition, Western Pennsylvania. Everybody, I played football up until my junior year. You know, I was on the team. I was not very. Not very good. I was a skinny kid and not as fast as I should have been to be a tight end or something. And so anyway, I stopped then, but I played all the sports, but focused on tennis. And and later in medical school and residency, I took up squash because it was a much quicker way to get a very good work. Not because I was saying, oh, that would be a good workout, but it was a good way to enjoy an hour very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So, interesting. How did that tie into your own experience with ADHD? And probably for you as a young person, I mean, I don't even know, was the term ADHD, was it in existence or was it just, you know?
bad kids, or like the Brits called them all hooligans, you know, all their ADD kids were hooligans. And but in the old days, you know, in the 80s, 70s, 60s. And but, you know, we didn't have ADD. We didn't think of it as anything other than, you know, we knew it was something to do with the brain, but we weren't sure. And we weren't sure about how to describe it and how to deal with it and what was the cause of it. But we do know one thing, like you just identified yourself as having ADD, and you were the paradigm that we wrote Driven to Distraction on top of. Kids that would come in and be diagnosed with ADD and look at the parents and they fit the profile, and you obviously have managed to do very well by exercising a lot, and we see this with all these. Many of our pro athletes are ADD if they stop. But when they're doing 3 to 4 hours of training a day, you know, their brains are really fixed and focused.
I think this is a good segue just into the effects on the hippocampus and how physical activity really helps with learning and memory, and how if people are having difficulty prioritizing their exercise, whatever that looks like, if you're an athlete or if you're just someone that likes to, you know, move your body, this is not just for physical health. This is for learning and memory and how you perform cognitively at work, in your life. Can you talk more about that, Dr. Rady?
Sure. That's the first chapter in Spark, you know, the school in Naperville that, you know, really is a paragon of what a school system might look like. Where you have 3% of the kids being overweight, only 3%, and it's 33% in the, and probably 38-39% now in the United States, and only not many at all of being obese, because they have an active program every day where they focus on getting kids fit. Also, that they score among the highest in the world in terms of their test scores. Now, it's an upper middle class community with lots of emphasis on learning, but yet they, other comparative places aren't doing as well, or aren't doing nearly as well as the kids from Naperville. They exercise for 45 minutes a day. They eventually all wore heart rate monitors and got their grades by spending a certain amount of time in their cardiac training zone for a week, and which is one way to make it equal. Now, going forward, people are trying to use this method in some schools. The athletes have a hard time getting into the cardiac training zone because they're well trained, right? So when they're, it's really something, and so they really have to get exhausted, or they can't get there, and they get a B in gym class, which is
you know, based on heart rate training.
Yeah, on heart rate. So anyway.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the book, Spark, talking about, like you said, that Naperville case. And then also, I think it was a different school where someone working, especially with kids who had what would traditionally be described as behavior challenges, you know, bringing in treadmills and other apparatus into the classroom and just how much that improves things. You know, it's super, super inspiring and something that, you know, really, like, that should be part of all classes, right? Especially as we see more emphasis on test scores and all that. So it's like, you know, gym classes is often the first thing that gets cut. I mean, man, if I was in charge of school, I'd say more recess and more gym for everyone.
And they show that improves test scores. I mean, sort of a natural history kind of experiment is the country of Finland. Mm. Now, Finland, two characteristics about it that are important. One, it's more homogenous, although there are plenty of immigrants these days. Two, that they really value teachers. Mm. They pay them well. You have to be really, you have to prove that you're going to be a good teacher, education-wise and all that. But they have the focus on the kids. And in elementary and junior high school, every class is an hour long, 45 minutes of learning and 15 minutes of play or exercise. And so why am I talking about Finland? Well, when you look at all the comparative tests from country to country, Finland is always in the top five. And why, you know, I mean, why, you know, how did that happen? Well, I think it happens because the kids are prepared to learn and compete with the Asians a lot. And I spent a lot of time in Asia, and they love Spark. I mean, it's just Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, Korea. I'm still working very much with the Koreans and the Japanese. But why? Because it's science. You know, I tell people they believe in science. You know, I mean, here in this country, you guys know that it's a question of belief. Would you believe this or believe that? And that's what we're going to do. You know, it's or that's what science is. Well, it's not my science, people would say, or, you know, it's but not in Asia. No way. So I've spent an awful lot of time there because people really want to know. And they want to, they've incorporated it very much into their schooling. Every time, well, two times I've been to Korea recently, I've met with the Minister of Education. I mean, it's that kind of importance, you know, to talk about exercise. Initially, it was about raising test scores. And this past year, when I was there, we were talking about bullying and using exercise as a way to decrease bullying, because it does do that. It decreases the impulsivity, increases cohesiveness and connection, can really help with the bullying trend. And apparently that was a big deal in Korea.
Yeah, taking all this and scaling it outside of kids is, I think that this is kind of a radical claim, but I think that workplaces should pay for the first hour of the day to be exercise, whatever that looks like. So Dr. Rady, you lectured for our class in the MAP program last semester, and I wrote a paper with a proposal saying that the first hour of the workday for this one business, the employees should get to go. They could go outside for a walk. They could go to the gym. They could do whatever, but they get paid for that hour. And because of that hour, they're going to be more efficient and more creative and better employees, and they're going to be sick less, so that it's a worthwhile investment to pay for that first hour of the workday so that the employees can be better. And it was actually implemented, and it's actually working. So how do we, create large scale of this? Because we have the science, we have this information, we have this work you're doing. America certainly needs people to be moving their bodies more. And one excuse people have is, I don't have time because I have to work, or I have all these things.
Well, yeah, no, it's a matter of the priorities and making the time and creating the time. I think the world has changed so damn much from COVID, since COVID, so that things are really looser and more flexible and perhaps less efficient. But that could be the time, should be the time that we then make a change to say, okay, implement your kind of program, the first hour of the day to be exercising. How do you do it? Well, you have to get the Congress, you have to get the president, you have to get people in great seats of power to bless it, and to not just bless it, but continue it.
Well, Sonia, I like the program. If I ever hire a real employee here at Macy Consulting, that program will be mandated. And I'm already carrying it out myself. And I would tell you, it's definitely helping me. Dr. Rady, speaking of obesity, metabolic syndrome, et cetera, you say at one point in the book, Go Wild, if you're going to take one thing away from this book, it's don't drink sugar water. And in other words, that we think of course, soda. You even go so far as to say juice, et cetera. Just period. Don't drink it. Don't let your kids drink it, man. I try to keep that stuff away from my kids. But my question here is a little bit more specific to athletes. There was a trend 5 to 10 years ago in endurance sports about high fat, low carb fueling. And some people found that worked very well, maybe especially in longer, slower events like ultra marathon. Other people, and even my own personal experience, I went pretty far into that. And for me, it wasn't a good fit. And I think I was just, I was under fueling. You hear of Red S, right? Relative Energy Deficiency Syndrome. And just kind of, this idea that like someone's working really hard. And again, we're talking probably at a level of training that's not sort of the general population. This is people who are focused on a lot of training, probably performance. People have had pretty bad experiences with it. We've now seen at least kind of in the high end performance area of endurance athletics, a shift to like hyper carbohydrate fueling. So you have, at the professional level, people taking in over 100 grams of carbohydrate per hour, which is a lot. We're talking 400, even 500 or plus calories per hour of carbohydrates, basically with the idea that the engine's running so hot, you give it a ton of fuel and you're just burning through all this and, performing, running, skiing, whatever, really fast for a long period of time. What do you think about this, Dr. Rady? Like, is... is there a risk to taking in this much sugar water? People are, you know, it's often taken in through, you know, these high performance sports drinks. Is it okay to take it in when you're training really hard, but then maybe not at other times? Do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, I know it's kind of a specific sort of question here.
It is very specific, but I would think, why not? You know, if you're burning it off, the whole point of what we say in the book is for the general population. It's not for the specifics, but you know, because in general, all the soda and soda water and Gatorade, even for a while, was all about, you know, high carbohydrates too. But
yeah,
and people didn't know that, you know, and now now it's become known, and so people are moderating that whole thing. And but yes, if you're running the engine as you know, super max, then you know you gotta feed it, and if you gotta use carbs, then you use carbs. Now, you know, but like the long distance, slower, ultra marathon people, they want to be using their whatever fat stores they have, so they like to get ketotic, or just use their body's fat to as fuel, and so they make a point of really reducing their carbohydrates. But again, you're talking about less than 0.5% of people, you know, and we were talking about the 99.
Yeah, yeah.
95%. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. No, that's helpful. I appreciate that. Because I listened to that the other day. I was driving up to do my ski mountaineering training, and I hear that, you know, no sugar water. And I'm looking over and I got these two, like, you know, bottles of soft flask of sugar water that I'm going to go drink, you know, while I'm out there training.
No, but you're burning it, and you need that fuel too. So yeah. Again, it's so individualized the way we eat, the what we need, what, you know, and all that. So, but they're general rules.
So I want to change gears and talk about biophilia. After the lecture I heard, there's two teams I wanted to make. One that said, I love BDNF, and the other one that just said biophilia. So can you tell us about this, Dr. Rady?
Yeah, well, biophilia, oh my God. That's what we started talking about, being in the wilderness, being in the wild, being in nature. We're born in nature, we're natural, you know, animals, living in nature. That's where we evolved from. That's where we are most comfortable in and should be. And that it is, nature has so many benefits for us. We don't even, you know, can't even, when you're out for a walk in the woods, it's so much different than walking on your treadmill. So much different. And because you commune with your natural surroundings, and it changes your hormones. You know, the Asians and Japanese in particular have something they call forest bathing, Shinrin Roku, meaning they go into nature and bathe themselves in nature, because most of them living in Tokyo and rat race world and fast pace and never a moment to stop. And they go into nature, and what happens? Their blood pressure drops, their sugar level drops, their cortisol level drops, all the things that you want to get to when you're in looking to be well. And so there's just a lot of good information, and people are attuned to it now, which is interesting. As many now, almost, I don't know, about 7-8 years ago, I went to a thing in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where people were talking about wellness and offering this program and that program. And there was somebody who was training guides for Shinrin Roku guides in Cambridge to have people take people out into nature and enjoy the benefits of being out and communing, because there's, you know, we have data, we have numbers, we measure stuff, and yes, there's big benefits to doing that.
Going into the book, Go Wild, building off this, being in nature, being in a natural state, you and your co-author are quite encouraging on eating meat in that book. I think it says something like eating meat is a fundamental fact of the human condition. And you go so far as to say that hunting, it turns out, there's actually this empathetic component, because to be successful in hunting, the hunter has to think like an animal. And this resonated. I've shared on the podcast that hunting deer and elk is one of my interests and one way that I like to get meat if I can. It really resonated with me. Tell us more about that. Well, why did you guys talk about that in the book, the hunting, the meat eating, et cetera?
Well, a big reason for that too was the whole fat phobia that we sort of grew up in, meaning back in the 80s and 90s, we were taught to be phobic about fat, that was really bad for us. And then meat in general was bad for us. And yet we evolved as meat eaters, and so it's part of our evolutionary past. So it's, and today we have so much of everything in terms of foodstuff, everything. So we don't need to pile into Burger King, every day and, gorge ourselves on meat. You're talking about elk hunting. My writing partner for the book, Dick Manning, he grew up in Alpena, Michigan, and worked part-time as a meat cutter. So he was, when he moved to Montana, he was a prime partner for everybody going shooting elk, because he could take apart the elk. Not have to worry about how in the heck they're going to get it out of the.
That's the hard work right there.
So, it was interesting. So we grew up that way, and we needed, it's full of all the nutrients you could want, but especially these animals that you're talking about, the deer and the elk, that aren't, force fed and all the other stuff that we do with so much of our meat sources these days.
So I enjoyed that part of the conversation. You talk about, ungulates who are ranging, or even more so salmon that go out in the ocean, go all over the world, and their bodies bioaccumulate all these minerals and stuff from everywhere. And then when you eat that, a lot of that's going into your body.
Right. And that's the danger of eating farmed salmon too often, we know about that, but, when you think about the salmon traveling halfway around the world, and their journey, and they're picking up all kinds of different bugs and things that they're eating on the way. It provides some of the best sources of nutrients for ourselves. Now, one of the things that I wish, people always ask me, well, what would I add to the book to spark? Mm-hmm. It would be a chapter on connectivity, being connected, and oxytocin. Oxytocin's a love hormone, the bonding hormone. And when we exercise, we get a dose of that. We get an uptick in our oxytocin levels. So it makes us more altruistic. It makes us more interested in connecting to people. And it makes others more interested in connecting to us. We send out vibes that we're connectable. And so when you, and that's why you see in a lot of sports. Now, you guys are individual sports people. But if you were, you know, a cyclist or a runner or, a swimmer, you would be on a team. You would have, you know, look at CrossFit, that explosive relatively new entry into the exercise world. It goes.
It's communal. People love it because you're in it together.
Absolutely. They get friends they never had. And they're true to their time, to their, what is it? To their
WOD, right? The workout of the day. Yeah. Everyone, and that's cool. Everyone's doing the same thing. Hopefully, you know, maybe they're adapting it to their own ability level or whatever, but, it's not my thing, but like a number of my coaching clients do it and I get it. You know, I can see how that energy, like you said, that vibe, it's powerful.
Yeah. So it really, it's so needed today, because just what we were talking about, the loneliness factor, people are so lonely out there, you know, with our little devices, our phones and everything, and the option of being ultimately connected to everybody everywhere, but a lot of times people aren't connected at all. You know, yeah. they're being fed digitally everything, you know, but
yeah.
no real bonding, no real people worrying about you, you worrying about others, and caring for others. That's a number one thing that we can do for each other and what's important is just that. My grandson's eighth birthday was on Friday, and I wrote him a card and saying, okay, you're eight now. Your big job is to learn how to be a very good friend, because that's what you need to be, a good friend. And you will have good friends, and that's these are some of the most important things. I didn't go into paragraphs, but that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is sticky and wonderful about something like CrossFit or team sports or even mountain bike stage racing. This is the example I'm going to use. In a mountain bike stage race, you are pros and amateurs race together. They're not in the same category, but you're with the same people every day for about 6 days. And you're going through the motions, you're eating dinner together, you're going to racer meetings together. And whenever you go to an event like that, the things outside of that don't matter. So like what you do for work or like your history, like all those things just don't matter. And it sounds like the same thing is for CrossFit. You are there meeting somebody because you have similar values and similar interests, so that you can connect in a way that is different than you would connect if you were just out on the street. And number two, you are undertaking the same challenge together. The speed might be different, the reps might be different, but you are both going through something, or you're all going through a shared experience together that builds relationships and bonds that I don't think can be built in the same way outside of that context. So I think that is one of the main reasons that CrossFit is so powerful and team events and things like mountain bike stage racing.
Well, you know, back when I went, maybe it's certainly not the way it used to be, but I mean, the cycling people, the indoor cycling.
Like track cycling?
No. Just anyway, but I'm talking about.
Oh, spin bikes, like a spin class. Yeah.
But 15 years ago or so, 20 years ago, maybe, when it was really hot, really hot. But it was very interesting. They did not run new people. They had their spin group, and that was it. And they did not want to have new people. I'm telling you, it was really amazing to see that happen, because they were so bonded with one another, you know, and they had come up together or whatever, and after they got to a certain number, they did not want to expand. They did not want anybody new. And I thought, oh, this is pretty weird, you know, but then the understanding that they were so into each other, And they went out for meals. They got together. You know, they shared experiences. And that's what you see in CrossFit, too.
Yeah, yeah. Spin bike tribe. Nice.
Yeah, yeah, and no. Well, running tribe. Come on, running tribe, bike.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there's, yeah. Tribes are great. You guys would both like one of my previous guests, Megan Hotman, set the record for the Guinness World Record longest spin class. They did 24 hours plus. And there were these guidelines, like you could stop for like 2 minutes every hour, you know, so people could use the bathroom. But anyway, that was wild. My final question, Dr. Rady, as we wrap up here, is just that back to the ADHD stuff. You know, if someone's listening to this, let's say they're navigating this journey, and maybe it's themselves, maybe it's their kids. Maybe they've known about it for a long time and they're an expert of themselves. Maybe they're just getting into it. They're learning about neurodiversity. They're learning about your co-author, Hollowell. I think in a poem he says, "No brain is the same." And I just love that because it speaks to, you know, the individual experience. Like we're all unique. You talk about VAST, this variable attention stimulus trait, kind of a new angle on, you know, this ADHD discussion stuff, you know, real quick, like what should people know? How can you encourage them on their own journey of like, you know, the great highs, the superpowers, you know, the yeah. wonders, but maybe also some of the challenges.
Oh, the challenges are great. So the reason why we're looking for new name for the disorder for ADHD, it's a disorder, right? It's a disorder. And so we were trying to normalize it and say, look, it's a trait. It's just their differences. And everybody has a different amount of their attention. And it's very variable. And, you know, in fact, we say that ADHD people might have too much attention rather than too little. It's just that they can't stay focused with it. And until they get something exciting, and then they're boom, you can't rip them away from that. It's one of the reasons why you probably were a successful endurance athlete, because you got into it and you weren't going to let go for anything, because it just fed you and it kept you at it. And you get hyper focused and you get want to get good at it. And you feel great because you're learning how to do it. You're getting better at it. You're feeling good. All your hormones are sky high, and so you have your own sort of nirvana experience, and it's not just about endorphins. You know, it's part of the story.
You've spent some time in my head, Dr. Rady.
It's an every person's story who gets into it. You know, I mean, that's really what it is. Michael Jordan wouldn't have been Michael Jordan if he really didn't like basketball or didn't like moving. I mean, he loved it. He craved it. He was gifted, but my God, he was also, you know, someone that just never stopped.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this. Thanks. Thank you both for spending the time together. Dr. Rady, is there a place people should find you and your work?
On the web, anywhere. I mean, I have a website that I haven't done much of with in the past 8 years or so, but
it's still there. It works. I went to it. I think it's great.
It still has some good stuff on it. So,
Sonia, final thoughts?
No, it's just really fun to get to chat with you. And I think this conversation was wide ranging with a lot of things for everybody. So thanks so much for coming on. And I highly encourage everybody to check out your books and your work, because it's really cool stuff. Thanks so much for listening to this episode with Travis and Dr. John Rady. I hope that you hit that subscribe button or the follow button if you want more juicy episodes like this one, and share the show with your friends, as that is the best way to help this podcast grow. Thanks as always for being a part of my community. And as always, I'm with you on this journey of personal growth, adventure, and our mission to be better every day. I'll see you right back here next week.